You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 19th to the 25th of January 2017. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Jack Grove, John Elms and Ellie Bothwell. Are universities buying the co-authorship of research papers in order to improve their position in university rankings? Jack Grove's lead news story this week looks at one case involving a Chinese university and a scholar at Ghent University. L. Raphael Reif, president of Massachusetts Institute of Technology, one of the most prestigious universities in the world, of course, has been talking to Ellie Bothwell about his institution's future under a Donald Trump presidency. And where do the world's top CEOs go to university? And why does it matter? John Elms has a feature this week on the THE Alma Mater Index. But first, Jack, over to you and that story on the co-authorship of research papers. A university you've heard of perhaps trying to buy co-authorship in order to improve its position. Well, perhaps, we don't know for sure, but perhaps to improve its position in university rankings.
Yeah, this is quite an interesting tale about a very respected education academic called Jeroen Huisman, who used to work at the University of Bath. He's now at Ghent University in Belgium. And actually, on Christmas Day, he was sent an email by looks like a third party saying, would you like to come and work for a Chinese university? He didn't really know anything about this university and he thought this was a bit odd, so he sort of Googled it and couldn't find anything about the university. So he emailed the person back and they immediately sent him a contract saying that he would be paid around £36,000 if he could produce three publications which would appear in the sort of official Web of Science, and he'd have to have, and if he could produce these, the money would be paid pretty much up front. And there was a few things about maybe going over to China a couple of times, but this was a bit vaguer. And I mean, it's interesting because he had no contact with this university, and then they're saying, "Would you basically write for us, even though that you are?" We have no contact with you and you're not really connected to us.
It was termed a visiting professorship, I believe, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Which sort of implies you have to visit the institution at least once or twice.
Yeah, I think there was maybe one or two visits scheduled, but I think it was pretty clear from the contract that what they were after were these publications. And I've been speaking to a couple of other scholars and they say actually this is quite common. A Hong Kong professor, Rui Yang, was saying that he has had many approaches like this, saying, please just put us on your next research paper and we'll give you this amount of money. Mm. And, I mean, it's interesting why they're doing this, perhaps to sort of gain international rankings, but also perhaps, and perhaps more likely to be domestic rankings. So China is investing millions, billions of pounds in universities. And if you get a few sort of highly cited scholars listed under that university's name, then you'll get up these domestic rankings and you'll look good. But it's interesting that these offers are sort of floating around in the academic world, and it'd be interesting to see how many people are taking them up on.
Yeah, well, I imagine it would be very hard to find out how widespread the practice is, but it's sort of from some of the quotes you get in your piece, perhaps a little bit more widespread than we might think. It's a lot of money, isn't it? It would turn heads.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of money, and people say, well, all universities play these sort of games and they pay big money for big researchers, but this is a bit different, Huisman would argue, because your contact with that university is so minimal, you can't really ever be described as being connected to it. So he's saying that it's a bit of a threat to proper academic cooperation. And obviously there's lots of money available and you wonder how many people are taking them up on their offers.
Yeah, page 6 and 7 in the magazine for that. Of course, you'll also be able to read that story on timeshighereducation.com. You'll also be able to read, Ellie, an interview you've done with L. Raphael Reif, the president of MIT. What did you talk about?
Yeah, so we had a big chat about Trump, and he was quite clear that Donald Trump's presidency kind of won't change the mission and values of MIT. I mean, obviously, there's been, you know, much speculation about what the presidency will bring, kind of how it will impact on US universities being able to attract international staff and students, on, you know, any kind of research collaborations abroad, you know, that research funding. And, you know, he did make clear that obviously he wasn't saying it would have kind of zero impact on universities, but he suggested that whatever impact it does have, the university will just have to adapt slightly and it would still carry on doing what it was doing. So he said that the worst case scenario basically was that, you know, the federal government says, well, you know, we're not going to be able to fund, say, climate change research, and then MIT would have to, you know, find other partners or other sponsors, you know, to fund that for them.
Yeah, of course, climate change isn't a real thing at all, is it, if you're reading any dispatches from the office of Donald Trump. But it, I mean, it's one of a few interviews you've done. What else did he have to say on sort of what is a huge week in US politics? I mean, we do have a theme running through the issue this week. Our cover feature comes from when we dispatched John Morgan to the US to hear from scholars. It's an in-depth look at how the changed political landscape will impact universities of all types. In news, we've also got an article about the role of academics in speaking out about Trump's state of mind. That's an interview by reporter Hilary Lamb, who spoke to Dan McAdams, a professor of psychology at Northwestern University, who actually carried out a high-profile analysis of Mr. Trump's personality last year. There's loads of comment, loads of blogs. I can't list them all here. Do check out timeshighereducation.com. But it presumably dominated your conversation, and it's a pretty hard issue to avoid in this inauguration week.
Yeah. So we did speak quite a bit of time about Trump. I mean, one of the other points he mentioned on the topic was about, you know, how good, you know, how successful universities have been at sort of demonstrating their value to society. I mean, obviously, this is an issue in the UK as well, sort of post-Brexit. And he said that he recognised that actually, you know, he said that, you know, people at MIT can be quite uncomfortable about the idea of advertising their research or their value to society, but actually, you know, it's really important that they do that more, and that you know, all universities, you know, do that more, particularly in this climate.
Absolutely. Well, do check that out in the news section, both online and in the magazine this week. John Elms, over to you now. The second feature this week, it's our somewhat regular feature. We don't do it every year, but occasionally publish the THE Alma Mater Index. What is it? Why is it important?
Yeah, well, as you said, it's not a regular thing. I think the last time we did do it was in 2013, but don't quote me on that. the Alma Mater Index of Global Executives is a THE ranking of universities according to how many qualifications they've awarded to chief executives of members of the Fortune magazine's Fortune Global 500, which is itself a ranking of the world's largest 500 companies by revenue. And I suppose why we do it is to, you know, see whether there is any links between, you know, the people in the top jobs at these companies and where they went to university. Obviously, education, a big part of people's future lives, and we want to see if we can draw out any links between someone's education and where they end up being, you know, working, and whether they end up being the number one position.
You'd expect there to be a parallel, wouldn't you, between the old sort of stable of big hitting universities, the Stanfords, you know, the ones we could all reel off, I guess the Oxfords and the Cambridge in the UK.
Yeah.
Does that play out? Are there surprises, or is it the sort of names that you might expect to see?
Yeah, unfortunately. Well, no, not unfortunately. Sorry, not unfortunately for the institutions. It does, you know. I mean, you know, Harvard, for example, is number one in the Alma Mater ranking. They have conferred 29 qualifications to 26 chief executives, are by far and away the largest amount, highest proportion of qualifications to chief executives. Next, as you mentioned, is Stanford with 14 degrees conferred to 12 chief executives. And then we have two French institutions, which I thought was quite interesting. Two French grand écoles Fachis de Paris, which is a business school, and École Polytechnique, which is a technically focused institution. And as you mentioned, the UK also has good representation, the highest being Oxford, which is 14th in the index. I mean, it's still very high if you think about the amount of CEOs it educates. It converts 7 degrees to 6 alumni overseeing companies and generating some $280 billion worth of revenue in 2015. So it's not big, it's not small figures.
And France and the UK behind China, actually, number two. I'm just looking at one of the charts produced for your piece here in terms of the top nations in the Alma Mater Index. It's a US, China, France, Japan, UK top five, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, no, absolutely. Sorry, I was talking in terms of institutions, in terms of how many kind of degrees were conferred by those institutions. Yes, and when you look at the nations and the CEOs in the companies, that's possibly the most interesting correlation that we found, was that, you know, in the top 15 nations in the Alma Mater Index, the statistical correlation between the number of Fortune Global 500 chief execs their institutions have educated and the number of global companies based in that country is 0.95, where one is a perfect correlation. Let's break that down for you. About 2/3 of the Fortune Global 500 companies are run by chief executives who have a degree from the country where the company is based. Mm-hmm. When you look at the top 100, that gets even higher. Roughly around 3/4 of the companies have a CEO who has done a degree in the country where that company is based. And, you know, I thought that was quite an interesting something to draw out of the feature, and so I contacted various people to see if there was, you know, if that, you know, that meant something, whether CEOs want to hire someone who is educated in the country where the company is based, because, you know, it might seem to make sense. And although there was no kind of hard and fast rule, a lot of people said, for example, Andrea Messini, who's the associate dean in charge of the MBA program at HEC Paris, he said, to have chief executives who are domestically educated helps, because, you know, you certainly have to understand the culture of the company, and who better understands the culture of a French company than perhaps French educated person. But of course, you know, that doesn't preclude, that does not make for the fact that there is not an international market, which is often touted. You know, whether that is overstated, the international market for corporate leaders is overstated. I contacted Andrew Owens, who is the co-founder and chief executive of Greenergy, a UK company, and 477 in the Fortune Global 500. And although he agrees that companies do not deliberately favour candidates educated in their own country, he does think that the international market's overstated, and he gives various reasons. You know, if you're a multinational with your headquarters, your operations, main central operations in the US, it makes sense that you might hire within the US, because that's where your centre of operations are. Mm-hmm. Or if you're a slightly smaller company with a market value of under a billion, you might not
small.
Do it. Yeah, yeah, in small comparative terms, you might not do a global search for a CEO.
Indeed. Well, don't give away everything from your feature, John. It's a fascinating read. You'll find it in the magazine on page 40, and again, of course, on timeshighereducation.com. That's all we've got time for in this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you do want to comment on anything we've discussed, or indeed anything that we've published this week, then you can do so on our website. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter and on LinkedIn. Well, that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.